Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Publishing eCast on FPGAs and Reconfigurable Computing Replace DSPs. Today's speakers from Annapolis Microsystems and Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing, with help from Praesum, represent some of the most prominent and credible COTS signal processing vendors anywhere in the world. I'm Chris Schufo, Group Editorial Director for OSP's Military and Aerospace Group of Publications and Websites. Of pertinence to today's eCast are our magazines VME and Critical Systems, Military Embedded Systems, and our all-electronic publication, DSP-FPGA.com. If you talk to Xilinx or Texas Instruments, either company will confirm that FPGAs and DSPs go together like chocolate and peanut butter, or baseball and hot dogs. But I'm increasingly suspicious of that assertion because it really only applies to FPGAs and special purpose ASSPs or SoCs. It seems to me that FPGAs are encroaching more into the general purpose DSP space. It would not surprise me in the next few years if analog devices, Texas Instruments, or other DSP vendor got out of the general purpose DSP chip business and instead concentrated on special purpose devices. That's my assertion anyway. That's because FPGAs are so compelling at solving both general purpose and specific parallelized signal processing applications and problems. In today's eCast, Annapolis talks about more reasons to replace fixed architecture DSP chips with FPGAs. Our speaker today is Dr. Sean Phillips. Next, Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing and their support will discuss rapid I/O and FPGA processing for high-performance signal processing applications. Our speakers today are Mark Littlefield of Curtiss-Wright and support from Kent Dahlgren of Praesum Communications. I'll introduce each speaker and give you their biographies before they begin. Now some housekeeping items. You'll note a button on your console to enlarge slides. You'll probably need to do this on some of the slides as they can get quite detailed. You also have the opportunity to download the slides, although doing so will stop the automated presentation, preventing our speakers from driving. As far as housekeeping is concerned, the briefing will consume about 50 minutes, 5-0, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the end. If possible, we'd like to add more time for questions because everyone really enjoys the interaction. You'll note on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker or company, please so note at the beginning of your question, such as CW or Praesum. Else, I'll parcel the questions equally to our speakers. And if you have a question during the eCast about the operation of the eCast itself, maybe you've got a technical issue or a glitch, one of the technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. And note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. Our sponsors have also asked us to insert several very brief poll questions during the eCast. If one of these pops up on your screen, we ask that you take 30 seconds or so to check the boxes and answer the questions and then move on. And oh yes, before I forget, this question always comes up every time. This eCast will be posted online within 48 hours, so if you've missed something, you can download it. And an audio podcast will also be available. More details at the end. So are we ready? Let's go. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Sean Phillips of Annapolis Microsystems. He's the director of the Customer Applications Group with Annapolis. He works hands-on with the major clients to develop both FPGA applications and the software framework to test and run them. He's got an impressive bio here, and I'm just excerpting it. He received his PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Washington, Seattle in 2004, his master's in electrical and computer engineering at Northwestern University in 2000, and a B.S. magna cum laude in physics and math, Youngstown State University in 1998. Sean, are you ready? You're up.
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, everyone. Today I'd like to talk about more reasons to replace fixed architecture DSP chips with FPGAs. We're all familiar with FPGAs. You basically have a... Hold on a second. You have a sea of gates surrounded by an interconnect. And... Give me a second here, please. I'm just trying to update my slides. There we go. Okay, we have a sea of embedded gates embedded within a reconfigurable interconnect. These type of devices are really well suited to fine-grained parallelism. As more modern FPGAs, they now have more coarse-grained parallel devices like multipliers, multiply accumulates, etc. Now, FPGAs are really excellent with a cost-performance ratio when compared to DSPs, and we'll get into this in a little more detail. But one of the drawbacks to FPGAs is they're really difficult to create and manage very large designs because you're typically using an HDL language like VHDL or Verilog. Now, DSPs, on the other hand, you know, they're more of a specialized form of microprocessor. Modern DSPs are moving towards more of a VLIW processor. This really helps them take advantage of instruction-level parallelism. The nice thing about DSPs, though, is they really do have a well-developed tool set, so you have a really mature environment to develop your algorithms and implement them on the DSP. They also have a lot of designers that have been using them, you know, for many years, so you have a large pool of designers to draw from, where with FPGAs, you know, you may be a little more limited on that type of expertise. And it really does afford them a fast time to market. But, you know, the drawback is, since they are a specialized form of microprocessor, you do have minimal flexibility. And it is fixed hardware architectures, so, you know, the resources are fixed. That includes, you know, the size and the type of multiply accumulates you may have, the size of the memories attached to the device, and more importantly, you know, the data widths. You're sort of stuck with a 16-bit data path or an 8-bit, depending upon which device you choose. Well, how do DSPs and FPGAs compare to one another when you're looking at just a head-to-head comparison with performance, and more specifically when we're looking at like a cost-based analysis? Well, Berkeley Design Technology Incorporated has done they've done, I believe, two different summations of the field. The most recent one has come up with some very interesting data. What they decided to do was, instead of doing a typical comparison where you just take an FFT or something and fill up the entire FPGA and sort of compare that to a DSP, they decided to do an end-to-end algorithm. In this case, they were doing an OFDM algorithm. And so what we have here in this chart is, on the left-hand side, we have the cost of, per channel of for a particular device, and on the right-hand side, we have the devices themselves. Now, on this graph in particular, lower is better, so it's a lower cost per channel, per OFDM channel. And as you see, on the left, we have the Altera Stratix 2 and the Vertex 4. Both of these devices are reconfigurable FPGAs, and as you can see, they compete very well, actually extremely well, with some of the DSPs that are on the right-hand side. The best out there, the Pico chip, is within, say, a factor of 3 of the Altix and the Xilinx part. So if we were to look at how many channels can you fit on a particular board, once again, we see that the Xilinx Vertex 4 part is capable of 432 channels, and as opposed to 14 on the Pico chip. So you really can see that with this particular algorithm, that DSPs are really not performing quite as well as the FPGA. Now, that is not to say that a DSP wouldn't necessarily do better on a different type of algorithm, but this is very indicative of what industry is moving, and it has a lot of good DSP-like functions in the algorithm. But there are other advantages you need to look at when you're comparing an FPGA and a DSP. And as I mentioned or alluded to before, is the tools. So DSPs versus FPGAs, how do the tools stack up? Well, you know, programming an FPGA with VHDL can be a very complicated and time-consuming process. It could be error-prone. This could really lead to a long time to market. It could be extremely expensive to maintain the design and to migrate it forward as the technology moves forward. On the other hand, DSP tools, as I mentioned, they're very mature, and many of them have ANCC support. So this really affords them a fast time to market and a large developer base. So these are two things that you really need to keep in mind. Well, how does the FPGA development environment, what does it look like today? Well, VHDL has been around for approximately 20 years or so. But unfortunately, as the FPGAs are getting larger and larger with millions and millions of gates, asking a designer to program on on these big devices using VHDL is really like asking a coder to develop an algorithm on a dual-core Opteron, say, with just regular old assembly. It can be very difficult. It's very time-consuming. So we really need better tools. And this is a challenge for FPGAs to really start to move into the market of DSPs. So really, the schedule with the traditional FPGA or VHDL design flow, you have two things that you're really looking at. You're looking at actually implementing your algorithm within the device, and that's usually not too bad because there's a lot of cores that you can get from various vendors like Altera or Xilinx or other companies, and you can sort of drop these cores down into your device. But really what becomes difficult is integrating the overall device into the chip, the boundary of the chip into the board. So this is talking to the memories, talking to your high-speed ADC on the front end, talking to another FPGA, so the systolic buses. This can be very difficult, very time-consuming, because you may have different clock domains that you need to address. And so a lot of the design time could be in creating this fabric around the cores that you're trying to implement. So really the hard part is not getting things to work, but really getting them to work together, and especially when you're looking at very large designs, it could be really time-consuming in those circumstances. So, as we move on, we really need to come up with a newer, more higher-level development tool for FPGAs, and this is where I'd like to introduce CoreFire to you. CoreFire is a GUI-based tool. And more, very importantly, it has board support packages. So these are packages that support, every board that Annapolis Microsystem comes out with. We have the board support package already there for you. So there's no need to worry about, integrating it into the overall device. We have a hardware-in-the-loop debugger, so you're able to actually debug your design when it's running. So it's not simulation. You're actually able to run the design since we're able to hold state within the device because we're pushing a flow-controlled design paradigm, where you're able to actually step your design step-by-step on the actual hardware. And the other nice thing is there's thousands of cores for you to utilize, so you really don't have to reinvent a lot of these simpler cores. It targets FPGAs like the Vertex, like pretty much all of the Xilinx families all the way through from Vertex to Vertex 5 now. So what does CoreFire look like? As I mentioned, it is a GUI-based tool. And so the tool itself is on the left-hand side, we see in the lower left-hand side, we see all the libraries that you have available to you. And so you pull in cores from these libraries, and you're dragging them over into the right-hand frame. And then you're connecting them up to instantiate your algorithm. On the upper left-hand side, we have it's going to give you the status, like all the ports and the connections and how things are growing, how your data path is growing as far as the number of bits utilized. In the lower right-hand pane, we have you have just general status, like if there's a D or C error or if there's a build error, because we do utilize the Xilinx tools under the hood. So when you build a design, we launch the Xilinx tools and send them the design that we want them to build. And like I said, the real nice thing is when you want to interface with like an ADC or a DAC or a memory, those are all built in. And it's really easy. You just drag out this core that will instantiate that connection for you, and you can just go ahead and just pull data from that. You don't have to worry about the clock domain that's running at. As you can see here, this is an ADC core. So this core itself is giving you an interface to an ADC, an off-the-board ADC on a mezzanine daughter card that's sitting there. So you can just go ahead and drag that down in there, and the data is just flowing into your design. And lastly, the nice thing is we do have a GUI-based CoreFire debugger where you're able to go ahead and step your design. It's actually running. You can step test functionality, make sure that the design is matching the MATLAB or wherever your original algorithm has come from. So with CoreFire in hand, we really feel that we've met a lot of the challenges that FPGA, designing for FPGAs have presented designers over the years. The nice thing is it has a validated board support cores for all the interfaces to and from the FPGAs, It takes advantage of the specific Xilinx parts used. So as the parts change and are modified and improved by Xilinx, we will update all the cores to take advantage of the DSP48s or the newer DSP units coming in the Vertex 5, or in this case the 18-bit multipliers on the Pro boards. And the nice thing is, as your algorithm changes, the changes all propagate through. You don't have to worry about bit growth or anything like that. We propagate that all the way through from end to end. So if you wanted to change from 8-bit data to 12-bit data because you want increased fidelity at the front end, that will propagate through the whole design in one step. You just go ahead and make the change at the front, and it propagates through. So it really allows you to have rapid iterations of design changes as your design flow is moving. And it allows you also to really do a lot of experimentation, which would cost a lot more time and effort if you were to utilize a VHDL design path. So the modern tools really do give the main experts a much higher level of abstraction from the hardware. So, we're really trying to alleviate all of the low-level details that have plagued FPGA designers till now. This really allows designers to concentrate on building the applications themselves instead of worrying about how it's all going to fit together and talk to talk to a memory or an ADC. And in this case, the time is really more efficiently spent creating the best algorithm and not worrying about the very low-level issues of hardware integration. So in conclusion, FPGAs really do have a proven cost-performance lead over DSPs when the target application domain includes computationally intensive, highly parallel algorithms. This is not to say that DSPs don't, that they don't have their place. There are certain algorithms that run very well in DSPs. And, as any designer would know, you want to really look at your algorithm to verify. But if you do have a lot of, computationally intensive kernels to your algorithm, then FPGAs are really a big winner on cost performance. DSPs have historically had a big advantage over FPGAs in their mature development tools, their fast time to market, and their very large development base. But as modern FPGA development tools come along, such as CoreFire, FPGAs really will increase, the design time for FPGAs will really go down, and you can really increase the efficiency of your overall design cycle and get the design out the door on a COTS board in a much faster period of time.
Okay, well, thank you, Sean. Certainly, as you've been speaking, a number of questions have been coming in. I'm not going to address those now. You have the advantage to get a chance to review these while we have our next speakers up, but I'm very much looking forward to posing some of these questions to you and seeing how you respond. So next up, we have Mark Littlefield and Kent Dahlgren. Mark Littlefield is a product marketing manager for Curtiss-Wright Controls, Embedded Computing's FPGA computing products. Mark has more than 15 years of experience in the embedded computing industry, first as an engineer developing robot vision systems for NASA, then later as a field applications engineer, technical program manager, and product manager. Mark has a BS and an MS in control systems engineering from the University of West Florida. Kent Dahlgren is the founder, president, and general manager of Praesum Communications, a switching and bridging technology provider located in Petaluma, California. By the way, that's in Northern California for people who are interested. Praesum delivered the first Rapid I.O. IP core in early 2001. Kent has more than 20 years' experience in high-performance embedded systems and networking, and impressively, he was the architect of the Xilinx Aurora protocol, as well as the Advanced Fabric Interface protocol, which was used as the core of the Rapid I.O. data streaming logical layer specification. He has a BSEE degree from the University of Manitoba. Mark, you're up next.
Oh, thank you, Chris, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. The title of our presentation is Rapid I.O. Core Design Decisions for High-Performance FPGA-Based Signal Processing Applications. What we're actually going to be talking about is some of the details of our Rapid I.O. Core, that is the Curtiss-Wright Praesum Rapid I.O. Core, why we made these decisions and why the core is suitable for, actually designed for, high-performance signal processing applications. Our talk will be broken into three sections. First section is sort of an overview of the composition of modern high-performance streaming signal and image processing systems. And the second section is a brief overview of serial RapidIO for the folks that aren't really familiar with the details of RapidIO. And the third is really the meat of the discussion, which is the actual design elements of the Curtiss-Wright serial RapidIO endpoint core. If we look at a modern signal and image processing system and the role of FPGAs within those systems in the defense and aerospace community in specific, you would see a system that looks something like this. Usually it's heterogeneous. It's a mixture of, say, quad PowerPC or DSP boards, single board computers of one flavor or another, FPGA boards playing some sort of processing role either in the front end or perhaps at middle stages of the application. You might have I/O devices, switch cards, and so on. But all of them are connected by one or even more, multiple connection fabrics. Serial RapidIO being one of the most important, at least for systems like what Curtiss-Wright tends to build for, but also PCI Express is very common for I/O devices, and Gigabit Ethernet is used very often in for command and control type of communication. But the idea here is that that they're complex and heterogeneous, and they have multiple data flows throughout the system. If we take a look at an example of an FPGA processor node, just to kind of put things in perspective, what you would have in a system like what I just showed would be a high-performance modern FPGA, something like a Xilinx Vertex 5. Perhaps there's attached memories, attached SRAMs or SDRAMs, or perhaps a combination of the two. But there would be also high-speed communications connections to the FPGA. In this example, we show a GTP channel using Aurora on the right and a GTP channel using serial RapidIO on the left. If we use that basic building block and take a look at some of the ways in which an algorithm might be applied onto the FPGA, we might have an example like this, where you have data coming in from a receiver, going through an A to D converter and flowing into the FPGA or over an Aurora link, a serial Aurora link. Various stages of processing would then take place, perhaps with staging of data into memories before the data is marshaled and then pushed out to the multi-computer over serial RapidIO. One of the important things to note here is that the data rates throughout this system could actually be quite large, many megabytes up to gigabyte or more per second. So at that point, in the moving of the data out to the multi-computer through the serial RapidIO, you can see that the interface to form that connection plays a key role. A second example of a system might be something like this, where the FPGA isn't necessarily playing that front end, that first stage processing, but perhaps is playing an algorithm acceleration role within the system. In this example, we have data being received, again going through an A to D converter, but then being pushed out through serial RapidIO to the multi-computer in some fashion. You may find some processing being done on PowerPCs, then going to an FPGA for some particularly computationally intensive calculations, again, with multiple stages in the FPGA, perhaps staging in memory, before the data is then pushed back out of the serial RapidIO fabric for further processing in the multi-computer. And again, you'll have similarly high data rates in a system like this. And again, the serial RapidIO block plays a key role. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Kent to talk a little bit about the details of serial RapidIO.
Thank you, Mark. RapidIO is a high-performance switched interconnect, like PCI Express, that was designed to overcome the bandwidth limitations of traditional buses used in embedded systems. RapidIO has a bunch of advantages for embedded applications, including things like system integrity features that are not designed into PCI Express for a PC type environment. This is going to be a quick overview of RapidIO. Let's start with the protocol layers. RapidIO, like most protocols, is a layered architecture. Starting at the bottom end with the physical layer, RapidIO has two different physical layers currently defined. One uses parallel LVDS signaling with a forwarded clock. And then there's serial RapidIO using high-speed transceivers and an embedded clock. And future physical layers are also capable, enabled within the protocol architecture. Above that is the transport layer. That's effectively the switching layer. This is how you move the packets between different nodes within the system. And RapidIO switches implement transport layer functionality. Above that, you have the logical layers. And this is one of the advantages of RapidIO, is that it supports a wide range of different logical layers. Now, the logical layers are define what type of data is being moved and how it's encapsulated. Currently, there's four different logical layers, and we'll go through those in a little more detail later. The physical layer is, there's a bit of nomenclature disconnect between RapidIO and the OSI ISO protocol model. The RapidIO physical layer implements both physical layer functionality from the OSI model and the link layer functionality. So it defines not only how things are sent over the wire, but how packets are encapsulated. As I mentioned, there's two versions. There's the parallel LVDS version with a forwarded clock and the high-speed serial transceiver version using an embedded clock. Now, unlike Ethernet and other protocols, which are datagrams, in other words, you send a packet and it's best service, best effort service across, RapidIO implements a reliable transport. In other words, when you send a packet across RapidIO, it's guaranteed to get to the other end. And this includes each node at each hop, the CRC, data integrity, the CRC is checked, and if there's an error or there's congestion, the packet is automatically resent at the hardware layer, at the physical layer, across the link. So very high system integrity, data integrity in RapidIO. Unlike Ethernet, if you get a CRC error, you know, you either use the data or you request in software a resend using TCP/IP, for example. But all of that is built into the hardware layer at RapidIO. Sitting above the physical layer, once again, we have the transport layer, which is the switching layer. And this contains all the information needed to route packets between endpoints through the switching fabric. Now, the routing is done, the forwarding, I should say, is done by the transport fields. And RapidIO supports two transport types, one consisting of 8-bit node IDs, so you can have up to 256 different destinations within the system. And the other uses 16-bit node IDs, which gives you up to 64,000. Now, you probably don't have 64,000 nodes in your system, but one of the reasons you may want to use the large transport is that it allows you, RapidIO supports multicast. And so for multicast, you redefine, you use some of these destination IDs as basically multicast group identifiers. And this is commonly used in high-performance imaging applications to basically spray data across to different processing nodes and to perform parallel processing. In addition to the destination source ID in the transport layer, there's a the F-type, which defines, tells at the transport layer what type of logical layer packet this is. Now, the reason that this is included at the transport layer is this gives you the ability to do switching and policy-based forwarding based on what type of higher-level information is in the packet. So it gives you higher traffic, better traffic granularity. Now, the logical layers themselves. RapidIO currently defines four logical layers. IO logical layer, which is non-coherent shared memory. The globally shared memory specification defines a coherent shared memory scheme. Message passing, which defines variable, how to encapsulate variable length messages and doorbells and send them across the RapidIO fabric. And data streaming, which is used to define how you take large data packets, chop them up into the smaller RapidIO packets to send across the link, and interleave multiple traffic flows across that link. So data streaming is more along the lines of traditional network packet switching, whereas the other logical layers are more oriented towards shared processing environments with processors sharing memory, doing DMA, and being able to do semaphores and send interrupts across the fabric. As a matter of fact, a doorbell is effectively like an interrupt in a packet form. So these logical layers allow you to do a wide range of applications, both shared processing, shared memory processing between general purpose CPUs, and pipeline processing such as DSP-oriented stuff with streaming data, and to mix that within the system. Now the challenge is choosing the right interface and logical layers for the application. So streaming data across RapidIO. If we're talking about high performance imaging applications, you've got high bandwidth data that you're trying to stream across to your processing elements. So what's the best way to do this across RapidIO? Well, there's fundamentally two approaches. One is to use a shared memory DMA scheme. The disadvantage of this approach is that you have to have knowledge of the memory architecture between the source and the destination nodes. The other approach is packetized data using the data streaming specification. That's really oriented towards the source, encapsulates the high bandwidth data, and sends it across the interface. It doesn't need to know where it goes in the other node. Now the disadvantage of this approach is that there's limited support for the data streaming specification in existing RapidIO hardware that's out there in the field. Now for that reason, and the fact that we have to support both the data streaming model and shared memory processing in the Curtiss-Wright application, we chose to stick with the shared memory scheme in this application. And here we have a poll question. Now I'd like to get into some design details of the Curtiss-Wright Serial RapidIO Endpoint Core. Now the key design criteria for this application were performance. We wanted to be able to stream data up to 10 gigabits across the interface, directly accessible through DSP functions in the FX2 board. Ease of use was another key issue. We wanted to be able to support and use the standard IO logical layer DMA semantics, but set it up so that they can be used efficiently in a DSP environment. So basically block transfers between sensor data coming in or from processors pushed through the DSP functions in the FPGA. Another key criteria is, you know, once again, this is targeted at mil-aero applications, so high system and data integrity and availability. And as a result, we made extensive use of the error management extensions in RapidIO. A secondary criteria that we wanted to provide some support for was processor-centric features such as messaging and doorbells using the soft packet FIFO interface in the core. And I'll talk a little bit later about what that means. So the endpoint block consists of a high-performance RapidIO physical layer implementation. There's a buffer MUX module that splits off the data streams to separate processing blocks for initiator and target functionality, and consists of different interfaces depending on what the customer is bolting onto the back end of the core. We support both the local link interface, which is a data streaming interface, for direct connection to DSP kind of blocks. But in addition, we also support directly bolting up to the Curtiss-Wright DMA functions in their system on chip architecture so that this can be pushed through using DMA into memory structures. The core was designed to support NWrite, NWrite-R, NRead, and SWrite. These are the different transfer modes that are supported in RapidIO. Slightly different encapsulations optimized for different applications. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to get into the details of that. There's a management bridge interface to access the internal registers. One of the advantages of RapidIO is that you can map the control and status registers remotely across the RapidIO fabric. And one of the things that's different about RapidIO versus PCI Express is RapidIO gives you the ability to map application-specific control and status registers directly into this space, whereas PCI Express doesn't allow you to implement your own registers in that space. This means that you can easily, for example, implement control registers to manipulate DSP or remote data acquisition algorithms and parameters on remote line cards. And the soft packet FIFO is for CPU handling of packet types not supported in the hardware interfaces. Now, the physical layer functions, once again, we implement the full OSI link layer model, reliable transport across RapidIO, up to 10 gigabits of aggregate bandwidth across the link, error management functions continually monitoring link integrity, logging errors, keeping track of error rates, management functions giving access to local control registers. These registers can either be accessed through the IPIC fabric with the local processor out of band from the RapidIO data traffic, or remotely using RapidIO maintenance transactions. So a high degree of visibility into the system state, both remotely and locally. The logical initiator interface, in other words, the local core sending out transactions, initiating transactions, supporting the standard write and read formats of RapidIO, so allowing you to directly push at line speed, in other words, 10 gigabit, data streams out from the local memory using the DMA or the pipelined image processing functions bolted up next to the core. So once again, able to initiate these transactions either from the IPIC fabric using DMA or using a local link direct pipelined interface. Outgoing transactions are monitored by a scoreboard that checks for a variety of errors, missing acknowledgments in the case of NWrite Rs, unsolicited or unexpected responses, error responses, illegal responses, etc. So once again, a high degree of system integrity and monitoring capabilities built in using the RapidIO features. The IO logical layer target translates incoming read-or-write transactions in any one of the standard IO logical layer formats into IPIC bus cycles. So it allows you to dump things directly from a remote node into memory on the board. Remote initiators can either be processors. So processors can randomly access read and write data on the board connected to the core, or sensors just pushing data remotely into the memory for processing by the DSP functions. And once again, the scoreboard detects and reports error conditions such as unsupported transactions, illegal requests, and bus errors on the local IPIC fabric, giving you a very degree of high degree of system integrity. Soft packet FIFO allows you to send and receive packets in software. Things like port writes, doorbells, and messages allows you to extend RapidIO protocol functions using the high-performance processor sitting next to the FPGA. Link alignment features. This is a way, a feature that we added to simplify interaction with the core. It basically changes the alignment that's used across the RapidIO link into a more natural format, which is D-word aligned, 64-bit word aligned on the local link. So once again, simplifies the interface of user logic. So that pretty much covers it for me, and I'll pass it back to Mark to give a summary.
Thank you, Kent. Thank you very much. Just a few quick bullets to summarize. We showed modern streaming signal and image processing systems are often heterogeneous in processing and are, in many cases, at least in cases in which Curtiss-Wright products play, are based on serial RapidIO switching fabrics. We discussed how FPGAs and such systems require a core, an interface for serial RapidIO that is designed specifically for streaming types of applications. We talked about some of the features of such a core, such as the flexible interfaces, the programmable VMA engines, the robust error management, automatic data alignment, and showed how all of these are very important to systems designers. And we the Curtiss-Wright serial RapidIO endpoint core was specifically designed for this environment with these features and with the eye on easing the integration problem, not only in integrating your FPGA-based code into the FPGA, but then easing the integration of that FPGA-based application into the larger multi-computer, again, specifically for signal and image processing systems. And with that, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark and Kent, and thank you to all of our speakers. Let's get right to the Q&A. While these gentlemen have been speaking, we've queued up dozens of questions here, so I'm going to go ahead and see if I can parcel these out evenly to begin with and then randomly as appropriate. So the first question goes to Annapolis. Since Sean, you've had enough time to collect your thoughts, what types of computer platforms does CoreFire target?
Currently, CoreFire, and in that case, Annapolis Microsystems Hardware, targets VMe, VXS platforms, PCI, PCI Express. We even have PMCIA boards. We even have PMC, XMC. We actually have an IBM Blade product coming out, which will have which will be targeted at the IBM Blade. Those are our current boards that we have.
Very good. This next question here I think is kind of interesting, and I'm going to address this one to everybody first, and we're going to drill down in some areas because this spawns a lot of sub-questions. This goes to everybody, so jump in whoever wants to respond first. Both briefings rely on the large SRAM-based FPGAs, and I think both companies talked about Xilinx. How does this info apply to smaller FPGAs such as Lattice or QuickLogic or even flash-based FPGAs? Anyone care to comment on that?
Well, I'll start. This is Sean.
Okay.
Basically, we represent a wide range of customers. So we have customers coming from many different markets, from communications to signal intelligence to the embedded military. And they really require a device to support all of those different customers. We really need a device that is pretty, it's a jack of all trades in a way, and that's really what the Xilinx FPGAs are. There are other devices that definitely have, that are specific, that have more particular functional units on them that have a coarser grain parallelism involved, and that are capable of improved performance on particular algorithm types. But it's really hard to target those at such a wide range of algorithms. And depending upon, what a customer comes to us and with what the requirements are and what they want us to build, right now we found that the Xilinx parts are able to provide, for us at least, that we're able to hit all of our target markets. So,
okay. Does that necessarily imply then that you folks are less cost sensitive in these sorts of applications than other systems might be? Not that you're not cost-sensitive within your applications, but if you look at a broad market?
It really depends upon the customer what they want to do in the end. If they come to us and, they need to do a particular task and cost is not a concern, then, using a more expensive SRAM part is a small fraction of the overall cost.
Okay.
If you were going to do something, that has a wide deployment, then using such an expensive part can be more costly, and so you might want to figure out how to get that on a smaller, more particular part. So.
Okay. Anyone else want to comment on this question? Again, the question is, why use the large FPGA-based, the large RAM-based FPGAs instead of some of the other architectures? Anyone else care to comment on that?
Yeah, this is Mark Littlefield from Curtiss-Wright. Curtiss-Wright has a little bit more narrow focus with regards to the product space and the market that we're attacking than our colleagues at Annapolis. This group in Leesburg, Virginia, at least, is focused on the group is called Advanced Multicomputing, and so what we do is we solve large hairy signal processing, image processing kinds of problems, mainly for the defense market space, but also we do commercial work as well. In that case, what we find is that our customers generally are looking for these large, SRAM-based FPGAs, that the smaller devices, because of the nature of the problems they're trying to solve, really aren't quite so attractive. Nothing that we've talked about today, however, would preclude its use or its application using such devices. It's just that our market tends to be driven towards that high end.
Okay. So does that imply then that you could certainly use Altera Stratix devices then?
Oh, indeed. And we're always evaluating basically all of the technology that's available commercially or available to the market to see how well they would fit for our customers' types of problems. We're in a constant state of evaluating those new technologies, looking at roadmaps, and in fact giving guidance to not only the vendors we use today, but vendors maybe that we're not using today, about how they may tailor their products to meet our needs in the future.
Okay. Well, before you ring off, Mark, since you're already up to the microphone, if you will,
okay.
Is the Curtiss-Wright Serial Rapid-IO Core available to license for custom designs?
Yes, it is. And in fact, our colleagues at Prayson Communications are the main point of contact for that. We're actually encouraging licensed designs because we feel that the core has merit in its own right, but it also helps us in that it promotes an infrastructure that's been qualified with Curtiss-Wright products, and it kind of eases the integration concerns that customers or third parties might have trying to mix and match technologies from different companies.
Okay. Well, that puts Kent right on the hook then. This next question is for him. It says, seems to me that Serial Rapid IO has some benefits, but is it really a, quote, don't care? Not clear to me to what exact applications need these features versus, say, PCI Express or even 1 gigabit Ethernet or just Aurora.
Well, that comes into, you know, a comparison of those protocols. You know, in many applications, Aurora is better, particularly for just plain. If you have streaming data applications where you just want to get the data across and you don't need a reliable transport, in other words, if there's a bit error on a packet, you just, you know, feed it through. Examples are applications like radar where the data is continually coming in and you're just refreshing the thing over and over again. In that case, things like the reliable transport in RapidIO doesn't buy you anything and just adds complexity.
Uh-huh.
In which case, one of the things that's supported on that FPGA design is you can use Aurora or RapidIO for bringing in your streaming data. Now, in the case of shared memory multiprocessing, you want a reliable transport because you want to be able to do memory transactions, reading data buffers from processors to
RDMA,
things like that. Well, I mean, things like Aurora and Gigabit Ethernet don't provide that functionality unless, of course, you put on higher layers of functionality like RDMA on Gigabit Ethernet. All of that's in RapidIO. Now, PCI Express versus RapidIO, a lot of it comes down to RapidIO is more targeted at the embedded application than PCI Express. It has advanced system integrity features that PCI Express do not provide. By the way, we provide both switching and bridging for both PCI and RapidIO, so we're pretty familiar with both of them. But for the other application is, you know, we're talking about replacing DSPs, but RapidIO has a significant amount of traction in imaging applications, both in wireless infrastructure, based on the fact that TI's wireless infrastructure DSPs have serial RapidIO, and in the mil-aero community because of their concerns for, you know, high system integrity and availability. There's a bunch of things in PCI Express that make things like failover and things like that difficult to implement that are relatively easy to handle in RapidIO.
All right. Well, let's move on then. That's, that does raise the point that has come up a couple of questions here, and I'm going to throw this out to everybody. You're talking about data integrity, Kent, which makes me think of reliability and mission criticality. This next question is right along that line. Where is security handled? And this applies to all of our speakers. Anyone care to answer that? Where is security handled?
Well, I mean, I'll just point out that one drawback to an SRAM-based FPGA is the fact that it's very easy to perturb it through, you know, radiation or some kind of bit error. In that case, we can actually affect the overall design. Since you've mapped a bit stream onto the device, it's held in SRAM in state. If one of those were perturbed by some radiation or something, then the design can be in a really bad state. So, you know, using SRAM-based FPGAs, while they do provide a lot of flexibility, they're not flash-based. So in that case, that level of security, if you want, I'm kind of reaching a little bit, you don't have that quite as much as with the SRAMs. But I guess the question really becomes what do they mean by security? Maybe in this case he means on the for RapidIO on the bus itself, and I'll let my colleagues answer that.
Okay. Anyone else care to comment on that?
Well, I guess since RapidIO is really targeted at a, you know, board-to-board or chip-to-chip implementation, you know, traditionally security is targeted between boxes where somebody has visibility into it. I mean, you can certainly build security at higher level layers on top of RapidIO. The inherent low level at the transport layer and the physical layer, there is no inherent security functionality. If you're talking about security as in protecting against data access, once again, the way we built the architecture is you could certainly do your own encrypted version of the logical layers on the local link ports and send that across RapidIO. And the switches wouldn't care. So, I mean, that's something that customers could add as a value-added thing for their application. If it's, you know, having the protecting against spying on the link is an important thing.
Yeah, it wasn't clear, actually. So if the person who posed that question, if you'd like to clarify, maybe we'll have a moment at the end to come back to that. We've got about 7 minutes left. We had three or four questions that are all very similar here, and this goes straight towards Annapolis. So I'm going to do the best I can to encapsulate three or four questions into one. Basically, it says, CoreFire seems similar to Simulink. Is that true, and can you comment?
So one of the things I talked about in my talk was the fact that, you know, doing the cores in isolation, so say you're only going to design on one FPGA, doing the cores in isolation in that case can be very simple. And in that case, CoreFire is similar in regard to the GUI-like Simulink. But the main issue that we really run into is when you want to start connecting these devices up. And I'll give you an example. The largest design that we've done in-house or for a customer in particular, it involved 19 baseboards with 14 daughter cards. So there was a total of 71 FPGAs that were interconnected together for the overall design. Data flowed in the front end and went through all 71 of these FPGAs. Doing a design like that in Simulink would be nearly impossible. It would be very difficult to be able to do FPGA to FPGA communication on the board, and then board-to-board communication amongst all the boards. It would be very difficult to come up with that in Simulink since it does not have a board support package. So that's really where we're different than the Simulink tool.
Okay. All right. What's the difference between Rocket port Xilinx? Okay. So what's the difference between a RocketIO implemented on a Xilinx chip with RapidIO implemented on a Xilinx chip? I'm taking a little bit of editorial license on the question. I guess that one's aimed at you primarily, Kent.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm not sure how this is different from the previous question, but basically, you know, RapidIO is a reliable transport. RapidIO addresses higher levels of the protocol stack, so RapidIO implements the physical layer, the link layer, the network layer, the switching layer, and higher layer functions. The Aurora protocol running across those transceivers implements purely layer functionality, and it is a datagram transport. So in other words, when you send a packet across, if there's a bit error, it tells you that there's a bit error based on the CRC, but resending that packet, that's up to you to coordinate across the link. RapidIO, on the other hand, if there is a CRC error, it automatically in hardware can rewind through the last n number of packets and have that entire sequence resent transparently.
So quality of service is probably the best way to summarize the answer, the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Reliability, quality of service.
Yeah, basically, and system integrity.
Okay.
You know, the RapidIO error management extensions, there's no equivalent to that for Aurora, for example, things like that.
And you would know.
Yeah.
Pretty familiar with it. Fair enough. A couple of questions before we go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to end it up on time. This next one's very good. I like this one. In fact, the next two, they apply to everyone here, but I think I'm going to toss this one to Annapolis. The question reads as follows. Unless I missed it, there's been no mention of floating point thus far in the CoreFire tool. How does this really compare to floating point DSPs like ADI's latest Sharks, or for that matter, anything from Texas Instruments?
So CoreFire is totally capable of implementing a floating point data path. You can just instantiate floating point devices to be put on, you know, when you're actually working in CoreFire, you set the data type and the data width. So you can just say floating point, you can instantiate an IEEE or whatever mix of exponent to Mantissa you want. The main issue you're going to run into is the underlying FPGA, in this case, the Xilinx, say, well, Vertex 2 Pro or 4 or 5. None of those have inherent floating point support. So floating point data path will inherently be pretty large on a FPGA, and you'd probably be better suited to implement that in fixed point.
Okay. All right. This last question is geared towards everybody, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up. So the question comes from someone that says, good talk. I guess he or she appreciated it. Can you use RTOSIS to implement interrupts, context switches in real time? I'm not sure if that's interrupts and or interrupts or context switches in hard real time. Excuse me.
Okay, well, this is Mark from Curtiss-Wright. Can I field that one first?
Sure, go ahead, Mark.
Okay, thanks. One feature, and we didn't really talk about the hardware components of Mercury systems in any real detail in this talk, but with the FPGA-based products, one feature is that we include onboard general-purpose processing, because we realize that you're not likely to have too many high-performance signal and image processing systems that are just a farm of FPGAs. Typically, you'll have a mixture of FPGA and more general-purpose processing. And so what we do is we design our systems to work very cleanly in that heterogeneous environment. So things like interrupts and such are an inherent part of the system. In current generation high-performance systems using Rapid I.O., interrupts are implemented, as Kent mentioned, using a doorbell mechanism. And so you have, in quotes, hard real-time. I guess the question would be, is how hard is hard? Rapid I.O. was designed specifically to try to minimize latencies, to try to minimize overheads with regards to such things, because it was designed to work in an embedded real-time environment. Typically, also, there are linkages between the FPGAs and general-purpose processors, direct linkages to interrupt lines so that you can interrupt in one direction or the other. And then when you're running on the general-purpose processor, you generally have a real-time operating system like a VxWorks or a Linux or something like that. Because it's a general purpose operating or general purpose processor, general purpose
okay.
operating system.
All right, thanks, Mark. Sean, any quick follow up to that before we wrap up?
Yeah, all of our boards do support VxWorks and real time Linux, so you do have the capability of a real time interrupt. And,
okay. All right, so that dispatches with that. So go ahead. Well, that brings us right up to our time limit today. I'd like to thank all of our presenters, as well as all of you who are following along remotely. As I mentioned at the beginning, we may not have had time to address all of your questions, and there are still a pile of them here. I'm sorry about that. And as appropriate, somebody may get back to you separately later offline. I hope they do. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 48 hours, typically sooner than that. And note that an audio-only podcast version will also be available for download at the URL shown there. And oh yes, you can also search for, quote, embedded_e-cast on iTunes, and you'll find all of OSP's eCasts available for download as MP3s. Also on your screen, you'll find contact information. Well, actually, you don't. Not on this particular screen, so you have to do a Google search or a Yahoo search on their companies if you need additional information. Thank you all for attending. We're adjourned. I appreciate your attendance. Goodbye.